What you are about to hear is part of the Podgods Network. If you have a problem with anything you hear, please write it in an email and go fuck yourself. Enjoy the show!
Thank you for choosing the Oddcast Podcast UK on the Podgods Network. The Oddcast Podcast. The podcast nobody is listening to, except you. The following podcast contains strong language, topics of discussion that could offend, and discussions about Batman. You have been warned.
Hello, welcome to episode 73 of the Oddcast Podcast UK, part of the Barker Podcast Collection. Boom! Yes, back for 2013. We are back. Well, I say we. It's just me at the moment. I've got a bit of a cough and a bit of a bunged up nose, so that's why I stand a bit like this. Because I could do it in Bane. No, I'm going to do my Bane impression. So we're back. We've had a nice Christmas. We had a nice new year, 2013. We've sorted out the show. We're coming back. Next week, you're going to hear me, Will Ash, back to normal. We're mixing the show up. We've got some new ideas. We're going to change it up a bit. We're going to add some new features, take some features out. Play with the format a bit, like Will said last episode. After last episode, got some good feedback on the fact that I did a Christmas Carol special and people liked it. Thanks for everyone for doing that. Coming back to me telling that it was good, because I put a lot of effort into that. Thanks to Rita Ramnani for helping me out, like she does. And I actually have recorded a promo with Rita, which I'm actually going to play to you in a minute, because it was quite funny. I enjoyed it a lot, because she's a top girl. But today, no Will, no Ash, just me. Me, my microphone, my computer, and a guest. Now, this guest is probably the highest profile guest I've had on this show. It's somebody which a lot of you Americans probably won't know who she is, which is fine. But in this country, in Britain, she's quite well known for being a writer, comedian, actress, TV presenter, a blogger. She's one of them people. She's a woman, obviously, hence why I said she. Her name is Emma Kennedy. A lot of people will know her from Suburban Shootout TV show. We'll talk about that later. That was pretty damn amazing. She used to work with Sue Perkins. Sue Amell, Light Lunch and Late Lunch and that. She used to do some writings for that. Richard Herring. She worked with Richard Herring quite a lot. She's good friends with him. And what she also does, she won Celebrity MasterChef. Now, Celebrity MasterChef is like a reality TV show, where they got celebrities to make loads of dinners and food, but really not really nice dinners. I'm not talking fish and chips. I mean, it's like proper tasty, gourmet sort of style stuff. Stuff which I'm too scared to even attempt to eat, because it's too posh for me. I couldn't eat that. But she won that. She won it. She's a Celebrity MasterChef winner. And she even shows me on the video the award she got. The trophy. Amazing is that? Because what you're going to do, you can listen to this lovely podcast with me and her, or you can even go to YouTube. There's a new feature now. You can go to YouTube and you can watch the interview I did with her. So it's down to you. If you want to just press stop now and go, whatever, I'll go and watch it. Go and watch it. Fine. You want to keep listening, you're not going to lose anything. You're just going to hear us talk. It's fine. It's been like a podcast. I've just given you the option, spreading it out there. You know what I mean? That's what they do. So the internet's now. We want to make more videos. Barker Podcast is going viral, people. More videos out there. Interviews. We've got loads lined up. I've already done a couple. They're all ready to go out. You can watch and listen at the same time on two different platforms. Because obviously you can watch and listen on the video and just listen on one. You may think, what's the point? No. You can't watch whilst you're driving, can you? No, you can't. You listen while you're driving. You can't watch whilst you're on the train. No. Unless you've got a nice computer with good 3G. And, either way, it doesn't matter. You're getting me views. You're getting me downloads. Fine, I'm happy with that. You're listening. That's all that matters. Okay? Let's not get in an argument about this. Me and you, alright? Okay, so I sat down and spoke to her. She's a lovely lady. She's very funny. Did intimidate me a little bit because her intelligence was a lot higher than mine. And we spoke about anything and everything. We went through a few topics and that. And she's a massive Killing fan. But not the American Killing. The Danish one. So that was interesting. And she's got me, I'm going to go and watch that. And I promised I would watch it, and I will go and watch The Killing, the Danish Bacon version. So, yeah. But before we go into that, we are part of the Pod Gods Network. And each episode we play out a promo. Today's a little bit different, because just the way I am. I'm going to play out my own promo. Why, you may ask? It's like, because I only just made it, and I want everyone to hear it. All right? So, but if you go to podgodsnetwork.com, you can go listen to other podcasts there. BUI, Garage Cast, 7 Days of Geek, Unsocial Network, Zombie Life Podcast, Two Funny Girls, and loads more. Okay, there's something for everyone. Canuck Cast, Canadians on there now. Canadians. So you've got Canadians, British people, and Americans. Amazing. We should get like a Saudi Arabian podcast on there, maybe. Yeah, maybe an Indian one or something. Oh yeah, that'd be good. Yeah, so I'm going to play out my promo. It's going to play. It's a couple minutes long. With the help from Rita Ramnani. She's like the most awesome lady in the world. And we recorded it. I had fun with it. I wrote it. I got it down. It was a bit of fun. So hopefully you enjoy that. And then hopefully you enjoy the interview with Emma Kennedy. Like I said, if you want to go and watch it, go and watch it on YouTube. Go to barkerpodcast.webs.com. It's a little tab that says videos. Go straight there. It's simple. Right, so please share this interview, tell people about it. You know, there's a lot of Emma Kennedy fans out there that will probably love to have sat down where I did and chat to her, and luckily enough she picked me. I don't know why, and she's probably regretting it right now. So please enjoy episode 73. We'll be back next week with a full Oddcast podcast episode, so hopefully if you're a first time listener, you subscribe to us on iTunes. You can't get rid of us now. Unless you delete us. Oh, fuck, what am I telling you? Okay, here we go. So here's a little promo for the Oddcast podcast to tell you a little bit about the show, kind of. And then enjoy the interview. Sorry, I've got a cough. I really need to cough right now. Okay, so I'm signing out. Enjoy the rest of the show. Okay, let's get this promo recorded, shall we? Where's Rita? Has anybody seen Rita? Where the fuck is Rita?
Morning!
You're late.
Oh, leave it out, Adam. I was in hair and makeup.
But this is an audio promo.
Yes, so I want to look good for the promo. What's your point? It's not all for you, Adam. I mean, I do have other things to be getting on with. This promo thing is a big favour for you, you know.
Oh, yeah, I know. I am grateful.
Good. Okay, now let's just get this done. I'm getting hot and bored already.
All right, then. Let's get this going.
Oh, hang on a second. Let me just get some water.
Okay.
Humana, humana, humana. Excuse me.
You done?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okie dokie. Right. The Oddcast Podcast UK promotional bumper. Take one.
Hi, I'm Rita Ramnani, and I'm here to tell you all about the wonderful podcast, The Oddcast Podcast UK. It's the podcast nobody is listening to. Can we cut? Sorry, can we cut for a second?
What's that?
I said podcast way too many times in that.
Sounded fine to me.
Yeah, Adam, but we all know how difficult it is for you to string a bloody sentence together. Do you know what I mean? So.
All right, let's just move on. We'll sort that bit out later.
Alright, of course you will.
Right, okay. Let's go again. Take two.
Hi, I'm Rita Ramnani, and I'm here to tell you all about the wonderful podcast, The Oddcast Podcast UK. It's the podcast nobody is listening to. Wait, cut.
What now?
The podcast nobody is listening to? Seriously, you still want to go with that?
Well, I like it.
Well, I'm sure I can come up with a better slogan.
Really? Well, go on then. Be my guest.
Brilliant. Okay. The Oddcast Podcast UK. It's the podcast nobody likes.
Cut.
The Oddcast Podcast UK. It's three dicks and a microphone.
Cut.
The Oddcast Podcast UK. A show what once caused several people to die of boredom.
What? No, cut.
The Oddcast Podcast UK. A podcast that makes you feel like you're on a constant period.
Ah, no, cut.
The Oddcast Podcast UK. A podcast that makes you feel like you have a tampon stuck up your ass.
What the? No, cut.
The The Oddcast Podcast UK. The podcast that is shit.
Cut.
The Oddcast Podcast UK. A podcast that taught my nan about strangle wanking.
No, cut.
The Oddcast Podcast UK. A podcast hosted by Adam Barker.
Is that it?
The biggest prick in Essex.
Cut.
The Oddcast Podcast UK. It's a podcast where the host, Adam, gets you to record hundreds and hundreds of promos and recordings, taking up a lot of your free time, making you feel like you're constantly working for someone who doesn't even pay you, when you could actually be out doing something productive with your day and getting on with your day job, as opposed to recording crap for a podcast nobody is listening to. Oh, give up. The Oddcast Podcast UK, the podcast nobody is listening to. Hashtag... not listening.
Alright, tell her where to find us.
Alright. Go to www.barkerpodcasts.webs.com or thepodgodsnetwork.com to listen to all the podcasts.
Read the rest.
I am bloody reading it. Also, find it on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Simply type in the Oddcast Podcast UK. Okay, can I go now?
And that's a wrap. Good job, Ria.
Fuck off, Adam.
So, Emma Kennedy, hello.
Hello to you, Adam Barker.
Oh, I like the way everyone says my second name as well, because I'm just like, oh, Ed.
Always.
Hey, you do.
It's like when... I think it's sort of like a retro thing, isn't it? Because whenever anyone was at junior school, you always called everyone by their first name and their second name. That was just a thing that just happened. It was always like Paula Berriman or Jane Atkinson. Or whatever, but and then everyone stopped doing that, and then everyone went through a phase of just calling people by their surnames, and now it seems to have come back full circle, and you must call everyone by their full name. I don't know why.
Indeed,
I don't know why Emma Kennedy. Adam Barker.
I have no idea, Emma Kennedy. So, but you throwing me off now.
I'm so sorry.
That's
all right.
Like I had a plan. I didn't have a plan. Everyone knows that. All my listeners would be like, he doesn't have a plan.
He's a planless man.
I am. They're probably thinking, oh, I know what he's going to ask her.
But that's not true, because you've secretly told me off air. I think, we can peel back the mystery of the podcast. You have confessed to me that you have got some words written on a piece of paper.
Yeah, reading, writing.
Reading and writing.
Things that, you're giving it away now, and people in my podcast think I'm a little bit dim and a little bit stupid.
I've ruined it for you.
But now you're giving it out that I'm really intelligent.
Yeah.
Ultra organised. Which I'm not. I am, but not really. A little bit. But so how's your day going?
My day's going quite well, actually, thanks. I've had a lot of outside admin to deal with. It's boring, but, it's just something that needs to be done. I've been to the post office. I've walked the dog.
Celebrity stuff, really.
Pretty much it. I was supposed to be writing some articles.
Okay.
I haven't done that yet. I've played a bit of draw something.
What have you been drawing?
I've drawn Robin from Batman and Robin.
Right.
And I've drawn Avatar for Avatar. Okay.
So that's a day in a celebrity's life. That's what they do. Yeah. They draw something, walk the dog, go to the post office. It's like everyone else.
This is what happens, yeah. It's very glamorous.
It is. It sounds glamorous. I'm a little bit jealous. I wish I could play draw something and go walk the dog, go to the post office.
Yeah.
And then come back and look at my MasterChef trophy.
Yeah. Oh, do you want to see it?
I'm doing it now. See, I'm throwing it at you now.
Oh, look. What's this up here? Oh, look at that.
Hey!
Woo! There we are.
2012 champion.
Yeah.
Okay, so obviously, if anybody's listening or watching on the video, and they have no idea what MasterChef is, because granted, there'd be people out there that are probably like, I have no idea what MasterChef is, especially people in America that are probably listening.
Yeah.
So explain what Celebrity MasterChef is and why you got involved in that.
Okay, well, Celebrity MasterChef is... It's a cooking competition. It's sort of like X Factor, but for cooking. And I love MasterChef. I'm a massive, massive fan of it. I think I've seen pretty much every single episode of MasterChef that there has ever been. And I got the call asking if I'd like to do it. And I think someone had dropped out.
What?
I think someone had dropped out because I only got the call like a week before they were starting filming. And most people had been told about a month and a half before. So, like, they'd all gone off and done cookery courses and things like this. So it was, like, it was quite terrifying when I arrived on day one to discover that people had been doing cookery courses left, right and centre to prepare for it. And I just finished writing a book.
Right.
And I was about to start The Killing Handbook, but I wanted a week off. And I thought, and I'd always wanted to do a cookery course. And I thought, well, this is perfect. I love MasterChef. I want a week off. And I've always wanted to learn, you know, some more cooking skills. So I thought, yes, I'll say yes to that. That'll be brilliant. Genuinely, genuinely thought I would be in it for a week tops.
Right.
and then, you know, cut to 2 months later. I'm crawling on my hands and knees across my kitchen, crying because I can't work out why my chicken liver parfait is not setting. It was genuinely, genuinely the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. And there was, I mean, and it's relentless, absolutely relentless. You only get one day off a week, and that one day is the only day you have got to practice.
Yeah.
The dishes that you know that you're going to cook, because they genuinely keep you completely in the dark as to what you're going to be doing on any given day. So you would turn up at 7 a.m. and have not the first clue what you are going to be expected to do that day. So the only dishes you know about are the ones that are at the end of heats, just before eliminations, the ones where you're cooking your own recipe. And the other thing about that is you have to declare those recipes about a week in advance. So the one day off a week you got, that's the only day off you have to work out what your recipe is going to be for the following week. So you're just riven with anxiety all the time. And there was a point, I think it was when we went from 6 to 4, because I hated the eliminations, hated them. And there was this moment when we went from 6 to 4 where my name was not called out.
Yeah.
And you see my hands go over my face like this. And people who knew me well said, "God, blimey, you're really like emotional at that point, weren't you?" And I can tell you now that I wasn't emotional. The only thing that was going through my head at that precise moment was, when the fuck is this ever going to end?
Really? It was a hindrance to your life.
I was just beside myself with stress and tension and exhaustion.
Was there people in the show that were getting eliminated before you that you were going, "Oh my God, they want it so much more than me," and I just seemed to be passing through every week?
The thing, I think you just reach a point where you think, okay, do you know what? That's enough now. I can't get any better than this. That's it. There's no end in sight to this.
It's, yeah.
And but you know, you just keep on going. I mean, the moment I got into the final, I did relax a bit, because obviously there's no eliminations from that point. So I just thought, you know, just enjoy it, because the experiences you have are amazing. And the only thing that's not bad, that's the wrong word to use, but I suppose the only regret I have about MasterChef is that when you're in it, it's so difficult to just think, wow, this is amazing. This is incredible, all these things that we're getting to do. And they've given me, you know, the greatest gift you can ever be given. I'm now really, really good at cooking.
Yeah.
And that's a life skill. Because genuinely, when I began it, I was just a very, very average home cook. had never made sauces, didn't make puddings, hadn't done pastry, never made pasta. Now, done any of these things, I would, you know, I would have a protein that would be in my fridge.
Right.
And I would slam that in the oven. And then I'd steam some veg to go with it, and that would be me.
So you weren't a bad cook. You just weren't a great cook.
I wasn't a great cook, no. I was a really average cook.
Yeah.
And they don't give you any help at all, none. It's all down to you. But the thing is, I suppose I've got a thing in me, and I think I've had this always, actually, is that if I do something, I feel compelled to do it properly, otherwise I can't bear it. I don't see the point.
Right, okay.
In doing things unless you absolutely throw yourselves in. Because also I think you get more out of things when you throw yourself into things.
Yeah.
And so I did, and I took it seriously and I did it properly. But oh my goodness me.
Hard work. But it paid off.
Yeah, I didn't expect to win, actually. I thought Danny was going to win.
Yeah, Danny Mills.
Both Michael and I thought Danny was going to win. But apparently my food was delicious.
Well, there you go. Maybe because you went in.
There you go.
Maybe because you went in there with a kind of maybe they saw that in you, the fact that you were trying so hard that even though you said in your head you were like, "Oh, when will this end? It's exhausting." Yeah. But they took that as she's really putting her effort into
it. I did. I mean, I really pushed myself. I pushed myself way beyond what I thought I was capable of.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that John and Greg said to me afterwards is that they said that the journey.
Yeah.
The journey I went on was epic, you know, from where I began to where I ended up. And I think that was it. That was a greater trajectory than Danny, because Danny was just very, he was consistent all the way through.
Okay.
And they do like zeros to heroes.
Well, is that especially because your sob story would have been at the beginning, if it was an X Factor, your sob story would have been like, my mother, she used to try and boil an egg in a kettle.
That's true, she did.
Yeah.
She did. My mother's never cooked me a meal in her life. Apart from what, there was this one occasion, I think it was about 11, and my dad had to go into hospital, so he had to have a piece of Teflon put in his ear.
Okay.
He's been deaf in one ear.
Right.
He was going to get a bionic ear. And he was going to be in hospital for a week. And I remember standing in the hallway with my PE kit slung over my bag, over my shoulder, not unlike Dick Whittington.
Okay.
If Dick Whittington had a PE kit rather than a spotty handkerchief.
Okay.
And it was like hanging off the end of my hockey stick. And I turned to my mum and in all seriousness, I was 11, and in all seriousness, I said, now this is your big chance with me, and I'm not looking after you this week, do you understand? And she looked at me and she went, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. And then I went off to school. Then I came back. I came back, and she looked really beside herself. She was giddy. She was giddy, and she said, "Oh, would you like to have your first course?" And I thought, first course? What's going on? I mean, but this woman hadn't even made me toast. Not once in my life. Nothing. Not even a cup of tea. And I sat down. And she put in front of me a pot of cockles.
Right.
And then we couldn't get the lid off. And then I said, what's the main course, Mum? And she went, rice and garlic. And I said, you know what, forget it. I'll make us some sandwiches. And then for all of that week, she got me every single day. I had to phone a friend. So yeah. It was a bit like, you know, who wants to be a millionaire, but for survival, not for money. And she would get me to say, oh, please, can I come for dinner? And then they'd ask their mum, say, oh, can Emma come for dinner? Her dad's in hospital. And obviously the relevant mother would go, of course she can.
Oh, yeah.
Of course she can come for dinner. like I was an orphan.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my mum would be nudging me, going, at me. And then I'd go, oh, can my mum come as well, please? And then they'd go, oh, can her mum come as well, please? And then obviously there'd be an awkward silence.
Yeah.
You think, what's this about? And they'd go, oh, yeah, all right. And then I'd have to ask them to come and pick us up because my mum can't drive. And then we'd get there and my mum, she just thought it was the biggest, most brilliant wheeze ever. Eating our dinner with my mum literally just laughing, like, you know, yeah! Can you believe we've done this? And then I would just be mortified. And then I would insist on doing the washing up.
Yeah.
At the end of each meal. And my mum would just be sitting laughing her head off like a maniac. And I would go to her and say, Mum, are you going to... gonna like help me do the washing up. This is at other people's houses, and that was when my mother came out with the now immortal phrase, "Emma, I can't pick up a pan; my womb will drop out."
What do you say to that at that age?
Well, she's just. You know, these are the things that she used to come out with, so it's all just completely normal to me. But for many years, I genuinely believed if a woman picked up a heavy pan, her womb would automatically drop out.
She sounds like she really had it going, like she had it spot on.
She's amazing, my mother. I mean, she's a template for fabulousness. That's what she is. She's got it. She has totally worked it out. I'll tell you that for nothing.
She should run the country.
Yeah, she should.
With ideas like that.
Awesome at it. She'd be awesome.
Yeah, oh, that'd be brilliant. I can imagine that. At number 10. Mm. Like, I can't do any washing up. I can't do any cleaning.
My womb will drop out. Exactly. See, the thing is, there's no comeback to that, is there?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
You can't argue with a woman who said, no, I can't do that because my womb will drop out. Because even though you know it won't drop out, there's always
what if it did?
tiny chance that it might.
Exactly. It'd be like, yeah, if I just called her bluff.
It's a one in a million chance that it might.
She'd come out of the kitchen with a pan. Look what happened.
Yeah, it's like that. When I was a lawyer, there was a case called the eggshell skull. It's a legal precedent, is that if you punch someone.
Right.
And they die.
Okay.
Because they've got what is called an eggshell skull. Like in normal circumstances, you could punch someone and they won't die. But if you punch someone and they die, you can't use as a defence that they had an eggshell skull. You've still murdered them.
Right, okay.
I think I remembered that correctly. I mean, I should make it quite clear. This wasn't Humpty Dumpty.
Okay.
They didn't use Humpty Dumpty as a test case.
I was going to say, yeah, they turned up and there's a weapon on the floor.
There was genuinely a man who had an eggshell skull. Look it up. Google it. Google eggshell skull. You'll find the case.
I'm going to do it now, and I bet you it comes up as Humpty Dumpty. Yeah?
Let's see.
That's the beautiful thing about Google. Hey, can you explain? You used to be a lawyer.
Yeah, I did. I had a secretary called Madge. This will surprise you because every now and again I do have some flaming rows on Twitter with people. Every now and again, not all the time, every now and again.
Like yesterday.
So what I'm about to say will surprise you, but I'm actually tremendously laid back. Okay. And this was one of the problems when I was a solicitor. Is that people would come in with plastic bags full of documents and they'd come in and they'd rant at me for an hour and I'd go, argh, like, I'm so angry. Ah, I want to sue someone. Ah, like that. And I'd sit there and at the end of it, I'd just go, oh, let it go.
I'll just get over it.
Let it go. It doesn't matter.
Was that in this country?
Yeah. Let it go.
What did Madge do?
Madge mostly just spent most mornings crying.
Why am I a sex?
I know.
She doesn't take any cases.
There was something going on.
We had three cases and she gave her up.
There was always something going on with Madge.
Poor old Madge.
I loved her.
Do you not speak to her anymore? Did she not speak to you?
No, I don't know where she is now. Dear old Madge.
She must be sitting there watching the telly, saw you on MasterChef, yes, and she's like,
nice cups of coffee, type up my letters.
I found eggshell skull, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. It says common law. It is exactly what you said.
Mm.
I'm not going to read it out.
That was well remembered by me.
It was. I'm not going to read it out because
that, I can't that proves it. I was a lawyer.
That's it. And if you go to images.
Yeah.
You've just got loads.
Is it Humpty Dumpty?
No, it ain't. You've got a load of pictures of eggs.
Ah, all right.
You got an actual egg. This is really boring, I'm sorry. You've got an actual skull, which is made out of eggshells. But no one really cares about that. So we'll move on, I guess. So you got into writing then, didn't you? So yeah, I told you I'm going by the list. Writing. We're going down the list. Writing.
I did, yes. That's why I stopped being a lawyer, because I wanted to be a writer. And I was just sitting on the tube one morning, it was about 6 o'clock, and I looked down the tube and everyone looked grey and ill. And I just suddenly sort of thought, oh, God, this is going to be the next 40 years of my life. I can't face it. And I'm a big believer in this. I think you only get one whirl. You only get one chance. And why not enjoy your life and do something that you like doing? I think this is really important. I think it's more important than relationships, everything, actually. I think everyone needs to have a job that they feel passionate about and that makes them feel fulfilled. And I was in a job that did not make me happy and did not make me fulfilled. And I didn't care that I was about to give up a very well-paid job indeed to go to nothing. It was more important to me to be happy. And actually, I've always held on to that. I have always had as a rule, never do a job that I know I won't enjoy doing. And there was one point around 2000, end of 1999, 2000, where I was offered a very, very, very big, massive, high-profile job, and I didn't do it because I knew I wouldn't like it. And actually, if I had taken that job, it would have changed my life completely, yeah. No doubt about it, but it also would have taken me somewhere that I wouldn't want to have gone.
High-profile job was in TV or anything?
Yeah,
or?
It was massive.
What, presenting job? Or?
It was a massive presenting job, yeah.
Can you not say what it is?
No.
No, 99-2000, I can probably guess.
I'll tell you afterwards.
Okay, and I won't tell anyone.
You won't tell anyone.
No one listens to me. So it doesn't make much difference. But you've probably done yourself a favour by doing that, by moving out of being the most laid-back lawyer in the world, which could be an awesome sitcom.
Yes, that would be, although nothing would ever happen in any given episode, because... I guess it would just be me persuading people not to sue other people just because it's too much hassle.
And Madge crying.
Yeah, Madge.
You have to change your name, though.
Quietly weeping in the background.
Yeah. the day you probably walked in the office and you went, look, I'm going to let you know, I've been sitting on a train, I don't want to do this no more, I want to be a writer. Madge was like, she'd already packed her stuff, she's gone. She's like, thank God for this, I'm out of here.
Endless weeping.
Did you never stop to ask her? Excuse me, Madge. You seem to be crying every day.
Every single morning. Every single morning, the first thing I would have to deal with was Madge crying about something. And she'd come in and sit down, and it would be at least half an hour to an hour of me just going, Yeah.
Let it go. Let it go.
Yeah, he sounds awful, Madge. He sounds awful.
So you start...
You've got what stain on your carpet now? I don't know how to get rid of that, no.
I want to find this, Madge.
See, this was before the internet, you see, of course, because now... well, you know, with everyone's got the internet and stuff, you can look up how to remove any stain. I think you'll find, Adam.
I think you can.
Any stain can be removed, but you know, before the internet, I mean, this is why we had secretaries. Does anyone even have secretaries anymore? Because people have their own laptops. Everyone does their own typing.
Get attacked by someone.
There's something happening here.
Oh.
Uh-oh. Poppy, I'm afraid I'm doing a very important podcast with Adam Barker. You may know him. Yeah. Yeah, someone wants a treat.
Oh, right, okay. No,
Poppy, you can't. No, I'm working. Forget it. You're just going to have to, just stare at... No, there's no point putting your paw on my arm. It's not going to work. Sorry, where were we?
Madge and internet.
Yeah, so before we didn't have computers. We had dictaphones.
Oh, right, okay.
So all the letters would go onto tiny little cassettes, and then we'd give the cassettes to our secretaries, and they would type up our letters. I mean, it's like something out of the 18th century now,
yeah,
isn't
it? Crazy. That's crazy talk. Now you got it all on your phone.
If we wanted to send a message to anyone in the office, we had to handwrite it out and put it in a little yellow memo envelope, and then the office boy would come round and collect them, like every 10 minutes or every half hour or whatever. And it was like physically delivering a message.
So it's crazy when you actually explain it like that. Like,
I know, it's mad.
I know, look, times before computers, I'm not that old, but I'm not that young. But when you explain it to someone, like, they're like, yeah, there's a lot of hard work going on, and now it's easy. Now it's like, yeah.
I mean the downside of that, of course, was that when you worked in any big firm, there would be an office boy, and there would be secretaries, and all these people were employed. Because technology had not yet been, was not yet available, that meant their jobs were redundant. But email and everyone having their own laptops, etc., it's actually put loads of people out of work. Yeah. Just think about it.
A bit depressing, really.
It is a bit depressing. Downer, blues.
Yeah, that's it,
blues.
Yeah.
Blues.
But, were you writing? You started writing books?
No, I didn't. No, the very first thing I started doing was, I think, like most people whose passion is towards comedy, so I started writing loads of sketches. And I wrote a couple of scripts and things like that, and they were all rubbish. They were all absolutely rubbish.
Okay.
But this is the thing. It's like I think of writing the same as I would a musical instrument or art, is that any creative pursuit, it's the 10,000 hour rule. And when you start, this is why I always think people who want to be writers shouldn't be disheartened when they're starting out and they're not getting anywhere, because you're probably still rubbish.
Right.
And it takes ages to actually become good at any creative job.
Hmm.
And it's exactly the same with writing. And I think for me, although, you know, I started getting, my very first job was writing Light Lunch for Mel and Sue.
Right,
and
okay.
So that was my first proper paid job. And then I was doing stuff for Radio 4 and things like that. But I don't think it was until I started writing my blog, which I wrote for 4 years, that I actually became good at what I do.
Well, okay.
And that really sort of honed my writing skills, and also made me work out what I was good at writing about.
It was learning, isn't it?
I think that's another thing, is that especially if you're thinking about writing prose, the big thing you need to work out is what it is you've got to say.
Hmm.
So during the course of that blog, the blog entries that I would get the most response about were always the ones I wrote about me and Mum and Dad.
Right.
And then I was approached by a publisher to say, can we do a book based on your blog? And that was my first book, the How to Bring Up Your Parents, which I don't really count as a book, actually. That's not really a book, that one. That was like my practice. That was my segue between blog writing and book writing. And then just one Sunday, having lunch with Mum and Dad, we just started remembering all the disastrous holidays we had, and then that was that. And The Tent, the Bucket and Me was born. Probably will be my greatest work.
Well, it will. It probably will be.
Probably will be. Yeah, but
that's always the way, though. It's like an actor. Like when an actor makes one film when they first start their career, they go off and win loads of Oscars for other films.
Yes,
but people go back and go, "Oh, Leonardo DiCaprio, he was brilliant in Critters 3." Yeah. So you're never going to get
It's almost as bad as Grease 2. Have you ever seen that?
No, I haven't. I've heard about it. But...
Right, so that's an awesomely bad film. It's brilliant.
Awesomely bad.
Not as bad as The Room. I'm obsessed with films that are so bad they're good.
The Room. Yeah, it's one of the best bad films ever. Amazing. We've done podcasts on it before, and I love it. Tommy Wiseau is so clever. I used the word clever because what he did, he seemed to create the funniest, not funny film ever.
I know. But totally with any lack of self-awareness about it, which is sort of amazing. But have you seen an American film called American Movie?
I think I have.
It's about a guy who is trying to make a horror film.
I think I have, yeah.
Midwest, and it's about him and his incredible best friend who does one of the finest monologues about gloves at one point that I think I've ever heard. And it's a documentary.
Yeah.
You're watching it. And I think Perks was the person who introduced Sue Perkins, I should say, for people watching from other countries. Sue Perkins introduced it to me, and when she put it on, I genuinely thought it was a new Christopher Guest film.
Yeah.
Until she swore blind to me that it was a documentary. And do you remember the scene with, that wizened old uncle that looks like a sort of a strip of beef jerky? He's like really... tiny and shrunken, and they're trying to get money out of him. And the payoff is that they're going to make him a big star by putting him in the film. And there's this incredible sequence in which he has one line to say, and it takes him 135 takes. absolutely brilliant. If anyone's listening or watching this and you have not seen American Movie, I cannot recommend it enough.
I think I did remember watching that because I think my friend told me about it, and he said you got to watch it because you like your documentaries. I was like, yeah, he goes, but you will not realise how great this film is. It was in the same realms as I watched what film was it? It wasn't The Room, it's another one I watched. Oh, I can't remember.
I need more of a clue, Adam.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was trying to talk to myself.
It was another film I watched. maybe just some facts, some small facts I might be able to help you out.
It was Troll 2. You ever seen Troll 2?
No, I haven't seen Troll 2.
Yeah, it was voted one of the worst films ever made. And then the kid from it was made in the 80s. The kid then grew up and made didn't stay a kid for his life.
Yeah.
He made a documentary about the film and how the film has become like a cult movie, which everybody watches now. And when I watched that documentary back, I was like, the director still thinks this movie's really good. But he doesn't understand that people are watching it ironically. And they're loving it for the whole fact that it's really bad. And they're getting the old cast members back. And he goes around to all these places in America and they do like midnight showings and he turns up.
I love all the midnight showing films. It's sort of amazing thinking now, like the Rocky Horror Show, Rocky Horror Picture Show. That began life as a film that was regarded as being so bad it's good again.
Yeah.
Which is sort of extraordinary because it's fantastic.
Yeah. But it's The Room, though. I want to go and watch it again.
Do you take plastic spoons and throw them? Or no, it's forks, isn't it? Or is it spoons? No, it's forks.
What?
You throw at the screen whenever you see pictures of... I can't remember if it's spoons or forks.
At what? What are we talking about?
The Room.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh,
sorry.
Selling yourself to me like as a Room aficionado.
I know, now you've thrown me.
You've led me down a garden path here.
You probably find out I was talking about a completely different film, wasn't it? But, no. But I remember listening to an interview with one of the guys in the film, and they were talking about Tommy Wiseau, and they were saying, what was he like on set? And it was an absolute nightmare. They said there's this one scene that really made me laugh when they're playing football, American football. Do you remember that scene?
Yes.
And there's the one bit where the guy picks the ball up, because it's a random scene in the movie, and it doesn't even last more than a minute. And he picks the ball and he goes, right, that's it. And it cuts to the next scene. They actually spoke to this guy, and they said, so if you watch that scene, when he picks the ball up and says, that's it, that's the actor coming out of character and saying, I've had enough. And so and you don't see him for the rest of the movie because he literally did walk off set and said, I've had enough, I'm not doing it no more. And he kept it in there.
I love that. That's made me want to see it again.
I think I need to watch it one more time.
Yeah.
So, comedy. Let's talk about your comedy sketches. The fact that you didn't think you were very good and... But
I don't think I am, really. I think I'm all right. I think I'm a much better writer than I am a comedy actor. I've always thought of acting as a bit of fun, really. That's never been my raison d'être. I've never pushed to be in front of the camera. That was actually a complete accident that happened. Proper complete accident. And it was Mel and Sue's fault.
Yeah.
I was writing for them, and then they said, we're going to do a show in Edinburgh. Do you want to do it? And I said, no. And they just kept asking and says, oh, come on. And so I ended up doing it. And I think it was just one of those things of being in the right place at the right time. And some Channel 4 executives came to see the show. And then I was offered two shows on Channel 4, and that was that then. And then I did presenting for a long time. About 3-4 years, and then I stopped doing that, and then I sort of went sideways into comedy acting. I think it was People Like Us. So I've been doing loads of stuff on radio because I'm always happy doing stuff on radio because I've always been good at voices.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things that once you're sort of there and you're in people's minds, it's sort of you just keep going along. And then I think I just finished doing Suburban Shootouts.
Yeah.
And I sort of had a word with myself and sort of said, right, now hang on a minute. Do you remember why you stopped being a lawyer? You stopped being a lawyer because you wanted to be a writer and you want to write books and you haven't done anything about this. And that was the point where I basically sort of said, okay, I'm not really going to do any acting now for a bit. I'm going to write books, and so that's what I did, and I've written 9 now. No, Poppy, no. Look, see, look, look, she's still there. Can you see? She's going, look.
Nice.
Yeah.
So what sort of percentage did you do? Like, what sort of shows?
The first two things I did were was the Real Holiday Show.
Right.
And I did a show that was called Flatmates. That was like we'd go to a house, and there'd be a room going spare, and there'd be 5 or 6 people who wanted the room, and then it was just a reality sort of like entertainment show which I presented. And then I did for a long time, for 18 months, I hosted a chat show on ITV2, but this was before ITV2 was ITV2. It was like before everyone, it was before Freeview. So you still had to have card. So it was like in the early days of ITV2, I had this chat show called Soap Fever. Right, and actually, there were lots of things that we did on Soap Fever that some very popular chat shows that are around today took quite a few elements from.
Right, okay.
I shall name no names.
No.
It was a great fun show, actually, Soap Fever. It was very irreverent. We had a live audience, but they were all sort of brilliantly mad old people. And there was this one little woman who, again, she was like this tiny wizened old lady. And we would have this running thing every single week that she was out of control and she was my absolute nemesis. And we would have these running battles with me and her. It was great fun. It was great fun. And it was unusual for its time in that the guests coming on, I used to absolutely rip the piss out of them. And we'd make them do stuff that you wouldn't expect to see them do and all of this stuff. So it was great. It was good. I enjoyed doing that.
So maybe it was stuff that was a little bit ahead of its time, you could say.
It was actually. Yeah, it was. Yeah, I'd put that down to the producer. She was called Rachel Ashdown. And she was absolutely brilliant. She's probably one of the best, No, Poppy. Really not. No. It's not time for your D-I-N-N-E-R. It's nowhere near time for your D-I-N-N-E-R. Do you understand? No. But she was absolutely... Oh, Poppy, seriously, don't, shush. Yeah. I'm working. Working, stop it, you're really naughty.
That's exactly what my dog would do.
I know. I tell you what, I'm going, come with me now while I give my dog a bit of kibble to shower up. Right, come on, Pops. Come with me now, Adam Barker. Come with me now. Come with me now. Come with me now.
So I don't think anyone expected to see this.
No. Right, there you go. That, and that. Now, shut up. Right, back we go. That'll keep her quiet for at least half an hour.
And then she comes back and starts headbutting you again, so.
Yeah. Okay. Now, where were we? Yeah, so Rachel Ashdown. So she was amazing. Amazing producer, and all those sort of innovations on that show, they're all down to her, really.
Yeah.
It was just one of those rare moments where You know, she and I got on absolutely brilliantly. I mean, completely understood each other creatively. And whatever she said or suggested, you know, I was able to run with it. And it was, I felt it was probably the job I felt most, free about in a way, in that I really was able to just be myself, and it was very relaxed, and it was just fun. It was great. I loved doing that.
All right. Sorry, I pressed the button and I thought I cut you off for a second there.
No.
So, like you said, you went and done Suburban Shootout.
Yeah.
So you've gone from like a bit presenting into acting.
Yeah.
That was a crazy show, wasn't it?
Oh, it was mental.
That was absolutely mental.
Absolutely
show.
Mental, that show. But that's the one show I think I probably laughed the most doing than any other show I've ever been involved with. Just the endless. It was all dirt because of Anna Chancellor. She is the worst corpser of anyone I've ever known. And also, she's just hilarious because she's so eccentric.
Yeah.
She's brilliantly eccentric. So we would be standing doing a scene, and then she would just suddenly stop and just go, sorry, should Anna be speaking now? Should Anna be speaking now? Should she? We'd just all be hooting at her. She's just hilarious. But also, it was brilliant fun. To be, you know, for women, I think. Number one, it was the six of us, and that was wonderful, because you never get to do that.
No.
All those amazing, amazing actresses. And also, to be like Goodfellas.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. I got to do stunt driving. I got to have a go on shot action, you know, pump action shotguns, machine guns. It's like being Tom Cruise.
You're probably a little bit taller than Tom Cruise, though.
Well,
yeah, that's debatable. Yeah, because I'll be honest with you, that show, I remember watching it.
Yeah.
But it was about, what, 2005,
2006? Yeah,
that one, yeah. Yeah. It wasn't until the other day when I said, oh, we're going to do a chat, that I went back on to look at your IMDb and all that, and I saw it, and I clicked it, and I stared at it, and I thought I made that show up in my head.
No, I know.
I didn't know it existed.
No, it's crazy.
What
was weird about it was that the people who loved it, they like really loved it.
Yeah.
And I was sent an entire, the good gang, the bad gang, the cars, the entire set of Little Stempington, all made in clay.
Okay.
By a fan.
That's amazing.
I know. Absolutely unbelievable. In fact, I think I've got the because my character was called Lillian Gordon Moore.
Yeah.
And I've got in my writing shed, I've got a little the clay doll that was made of me by this woman. It's amazing.
She made it all herself.
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Must have taken her hours, weeks.
Couple of days.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Because I do remember saying to someone, a couple of years back when I did, well, when I remember watching it, I remember saying, do you remember this show that used to be, it was on Channel 5, wasn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Well, do you remember this show where there's load of women on this sort of little town shooting each other and acting like mobsters and mob wives and that? And they looked at me as if I was going crazy. And I think that's why I then thought, I think I made that up. I don't think that show existed.
Yeah, you just dreamed it.
Yeah, and it wasn't until I was looking at it, I was like, I remember that show.
Yeah.
I remember watching that show. I remember it being absolutely mental.
Really good fun to make, that was. Really good fun to make.
But that was the show that then decided you thought, let's get back to writing, shall we?
Well, it was, you know, the time was right. It had been nagging at me. That I'd given up being a lawyer quite specifically to be a writer, and I'd been sidetracked for the best part of 10 years.
Yeah.
And I'll keep, you know, I, 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 I'll come back to this again, but it's like the acting isn't the thing that validates me. Acting isn't the thing that drives me on. It is for some people. Some people want to be in front of the camera and like everything that goes with that. But for me, it's not important. It's really not important. It's more important for me to write.
So you do a lot of writing for do you do magazine writing, do journalism writing? Is it The Guardian you do?
I was a travel columnist for The Guardian. That's it. That came about because of Tent the Bucket and Me.
Yeah.
And also I left my tent in San Francisco, that both of which are books that are based on my disastrous attempts to go travelling or on holiday. Right. And it turns out it's true. I am really bad at going anywhere.
But I think people would like to hear that, though.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
Nobody wants to hear someone say, oh, I went to this place, it was really nice, it was lovely, I sat on the beach and I did nothing. They want to hear you, I lost my luggage, I couldn't get this tent going, I stubbed my toe.
What sums me up in a nutshell is massive enthusiasm coupled with no or little talent to do things. You know, so it's like, you know, when I was sent river bobbing, I didn't even know what river bobbing was. I thought it was going to involve some sort of craft or an inflatable or something. But this is where the enthusiasm kicks in, is that if someone says to me, do you want to try something? I will literally do anything.
Right.
I will literally do anything. And no one had actually bothered to ask if I was any good at swimming, which I'm not. I was the only child at my school to fail their junior watermanship.
Right.
And
how'd you fail it? Did you just drown? Is that how you fail? Not swimming?
Drowning. Well, I was just rubbish at everything. I couldn't finish the whatever length it was you had to swim, and I got out and...
Well, that's rubbish,
not,
though, isn't it?
I'm not good at it. I'm just not good at it. I can't dive, can't do anything. And so I find myself standing on the bank of a Welsh river in early February. It's freezing. The water is running. It's dark. It's black like treacle, and it's running like a whip.
Right.
And I get to the bank, and I say, and I turn to the instructor, and I say, where's the... where's the boat? Canoe, where is it? Where's the dinghy? And he went, oh, no, there's no dinghy. No, there's no net. I'm just going to shove you in. At which point I was literally shoved in. I mean, I had a wetsuit on and a helmet. and I just went like that in this water, just took me like that, whoosh. And I could hear the guy shouting behind me, and he said to me, he went, take a deep breath before you hit the white water, like that. And I could hear the rapids coming up, and then I could see them, and I thought, right, okay, just take a deep breath. It's called river bobbing because obviously I will bob through.
Yeah.
This is just bobbing. It's just bobbing. So I took a deep breath, and then I hit the first wave of white water, and the water went straight up my nose.
Oh, that's the worst.
And so I started to choke, and then I couldn't take a breath because the second one hit me, and it went up my nose again, and it happened again, and then it happened again. It happened four times, and then I went under.
Right.
And then an extraordinary thing happened, which is apparently what happens to you when your brain knows you're dying.
Right.
I was flooded with endorphins, and I suddenly became incredibly calm, and I very, very calmly just thought, oh, okay, I'm drowning.
Okay.
I'm drowning now. And the weird thing was, I felt fine about it, but that was because my brain
I told you.
Had understood that's it. You're about to die. So just feel fine about it. Now, that would have been the end of me.
And we wouldn't be here.
That would have been the end of me. Except, and this is another example of just the random things that I seem to constantly encounter. By chance, the fire brigade were having an exercise about 10 metres away from where I went down. And one of them saw me go under and not come back up again and dived in, saved me, and the next thing I knew, I was lying on a rock having water pumped out of my lungs by a fireman. And the first thing I thought as I came round was, oh, this is going to be a funny column.
Not like, oh, I'm okay, I nearly died. No. It's all about work with you, isn't it?
This is the thing, I do slightly like it when things go to hell. Because it's funnier. It's funnier. It's like, you know, like I left my tent in San Francisco. There wouldn't even have been a book in that if I had gone to America and gone to San Francisco and got a job the same day. There would have been no book. But the fact that I went to America genuinely thinking, okay, I'm going to make my fortune because I've got nice teeth and a reasonably pleasant English accent.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the exact opposite happened, and it took me over 2 months to find a job. I mean, the one of the most brilliant things that happened on that journey, and I had completely forgotten about it until I read the diary of the friend that I went with. She gave me her diary that I could use for the book. And both of us had completely forgotten that this happened, and it was just a question of we had sellotaped it onto the relevant page of the day that this happened. And we'd been looking for a job for over 2 months, and we suddenly we got nowhere, nothing, and I think we were literally down to, we had under $10 in our pockets, and we were desperate, absolutely desperate. And we saw an English fish and chip shop, and there's a wanted sign up in the window, and we were beside ourselves, and we went running in. We went, we're here! We're here! We know everything about fish and chips. There is nothing we do not know about fish and chips. We're here to do the job. We're here, hire us. Brilliant. We're even English. And she had just given the jobs away, so there were no jobs.
Right.
And we were absolutely crestfallen. And she had this bowl of fortune cookies next to the till. And my friend took one out and she opened it up, and it said, you have the constitution of an ox, which was true, because she did. And then I took my fortune cookie, and this is the thing that we'd forgotten about. But we had glued in. We'd glued this fortune cookie in to her diary.
Right.
And my fortune cookie said, bad luck and misfortune will haunt you for all eternity.
That's what you want to hear from what you want to read from a fortune cookie, is it?
Exactly. Bad luck and misfortune will haunt you for all eternity.
What do you think the person that was making him fortune cookies up that day was like, I've had enough of all this, you know, positive bullshit.
They do say that, you know, like every 1 million or whatever fortune cookies, you get a really bad one.
Yeah, you're going to die tonight or something like that.
And I got one.
But then again, it worked. If it's 1 in a million, what did you get in it?
But, you know, it's just like, you know, I would never have remembered that if it had just gone, oh, you'll meet someone nice today or something. It's just like, I don't know whether it's an English thing. I don't know. But I just think we secretly love it when things go tits up, don't we?
Oh, yeah, we live for it. We don't like it when things go smoothly.
No, so I've had plenty of lovely holidays. I can't remember one of them.
It's not exciting, is it?
No.
Very self-deprecating people.
No, I think we're very good at laughing at ourselves. I think as long as that's that. I think actually that's the sort of humour I like the most. As long as you're making yourself the main butt of the joke, I think you can get away with murder, really.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I much prefer that.
Yeah.
Than punching, than comedy that punches down all the time. I don't like that sort of comedy.
What do you mean, like people that aim at other people to make themselves look better?
I think there are targets.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's very easy to make fun of people who are disabled or
yeah
whatever, and I don't really. See the point in it. My starting position is, and I should make this quite clear, is that you can make jokes about anything.
Right.
And you can make jokes about everything. And that should always be your starting position. But I also think just because you can make a joke about something, it doesn't mean you necessarily should make a joke about something.
Well, exactly.
Be the better person. Be the better person, I think.
It's like some comedians out there, I'm not going to name any names, but there's a lot of comedians out there which do certain kind of jokes which you would hear down a pub. And
yeah, I mean, but the thing is, I mean, there are some stand-up comedians I cannot bear, but you know they're incredibly popular. And the thing about comedy is that there is always something for everybody. It's like sitcoms.
Mm.
It's like sitcoms, and sorry, I'm just having to text Alison Moyet to tell her I can't text her yet because I'm doing this podcast.
With Adam Barker.
Yeah. Just doing a live podcast, Alison Moyet. I can't chat to you right now.
I'll let you finish, that's fine.
I'm sorry about this.
That's all right, Alison Moyet, she's bigger than me.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Anyway, right.
I completely forgot what we were talking about. I'm looking at my list, I don't even know what I've written down now. Writing and reading, that's done. So, should we talk about, you're a massive Twitter fan, aren't you?
Yeah, I love Twitter.
Obviously.
It drives around the bend.
But I think that's the beauty of Twitter, though. That's the beauty of it, though. Yeah.
I think all of us have gone on a bit of a journey with Twitter because, you know, back when Twitter was box fresh and, I've made terrible mistakes on Twitter. Terrible mistakes, things I really shouldn't have done.
Drunk tweeting,
but you learn. Oh, the worst thing I did was call Robert Webb a cunt.
Well, for Mitchell Webb.
Mm.
Did you mean it, or was it kind of more of a laughable cunt?
I had flu at the time, and I was tired, and I was in a grump, and it wasn't fishbowl, and. It wasn't a timeline to it. What had happened was that he was doing a voiceover for something, and I very rudely, I think now in retrospect, very rudely just said, "Oh, I can't bear it when I don't like him voiceovers," and I absolutely should not have said that.
Yeah,
I absolutely should not have said that. And then I got sort of embroiled in a conversation with someone. And I called him a cunt, and it's my biggest regret on Twitter. I should never, ever have done that. Should never have done it.
But did you learn from it?
I apologise unreservedly for that now. It sticks with me, that does. But you know what? It's like once you've done it and it's out there and people... you forget that people are following you. That's the problem. You actually forget people are following you. Even Poppy's crying about me calling Robert Webb a cunt, but she's crying. Crying. So what a terrible thing you did, Emma Kennedy.
She's like, I love that show. I love his shows. I love his voiceovers.
I don't know why I said it. It was just madness.
Don't you feel that sometimes when you write a tweet out, you're kind of subconsciously saying it in your head, you write it down and you tweet it and you're just like, I didn't come across like I wanted it to. I shouldn't have said that.
You know what? I mean, it's. I mean, this is the thing. That was a long. It was a long time ago that happened. I'd never do that now. Never, ever, ever. You just learn that when. I mean, especially. I mean, that was when I think I only had about 5,000 followers back then when I did that.
Yeah.
And the more followers you get, the more careful you have to be, really, you know, and the more twit fights you get involved with, you know, it's like every single time you just learn,
yeah,
that you shouldn't really do it.
See, obviously I don't have that many followers. I only have about 1,000, but I try not to get to any arguments on Twitter at all, because I don't like arguments in real life, let alone on Twitter.
No, this is it. I can't remember the last argument I had in real life. It's a weird thing.
The same thing. I try to ignore them all. I try to skim over arguments.
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I've only had really about 3 or 4 really big, massive fights on Twitter. And given the amount of followers I have and the amount of time I've been on Twitter, actually, I don't think that's that bad. But it always feels at the time like a massive thing, but it isn't really.
No.
These things happen every day on Twitter. But it's interesting. It's like yesterday, two days ago, like Donald Trump tweeted he was moaning about Obama trying to introduce legislation to get rid of semi-automatic weapons. And I think this is something we don't have a problem with in the UK.
No.
The fact that I genuinely think it is insane that people can go into a supermarket and buy a machine gun or a semi-automatic weapon.
Right.
To me, that is, it's madness. It's absolute madness. But some Americans feel very, very differently about that. And I think I just replied to him saying, you know, can you explain why civilians need semi-automatic weapons? That was just a tweet to him.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, and this happens every time I ever get involved with Julian Assange as well.
Right.
Is that I will then get a barrage of abusive tweets from people who don't follow me.
Probably don't even know you are.
Are just obsessed with guns. Just a mess with guns.
Yeah.
Just loads of Americans basically telling me I'm a dumb bitch and have I got a brain and...
I did see those. I did go back and see those.
It's amazing, isn't it? Just amazing. And you just think, wow. It's like you're so angry that someone holds a contrary opinion to yours. You're so livid about it that you go out of your way to tweet someone you don't follow to just send them a rude tweet. That bit of Twitter I will never understand.
Well, so they're the bad, weird things about Twitter that people sort of focus on, but I like the positive parts of it.
Oh,
where
I love Twitter.
I seem to, like, when you seem to find people that you would never normally talk to,
yeah,
or people the same interests as you. That's what I always try and sell it as to people, because people are like, so why do you use Twitter? I don't want to talk to strangers. No, but I can talk about something which I'm interested in,
yeah,
and I'll be able to find people out there with the same interests, and I can talk to them. Mm-hmm. If I go to Facebook and I want to talk about, say, a football match, and I know half my friends are all West Ham fans, they're not really going to want to talk to me about it.
No.
You see, I like the finding people. That
I love. I'm exactly the same. I love the sharing aspect of it. I love it. I find it informative. I find it fun. I've genuinely made some amazing friends on it, and I've made friends with people who I never would have ever have met. Like, there's one of my favourite people to follow is called ScottyFish75, and I just adore him. And he's married. He's a stay at home dad. He's like a house husband, and he bakes cakes for his wife and his kids, and he loves his kids and he loves his wife, and he's really funny, and he lives up in Newcastle somewhere, and I've never met him, and I would love to meet him and go out for a drink with him. I really genuinely think of him as my pals.
Yeah. I think that's the good thing about it. I mean, like, I think when I started following you, it wasn't because of all Suburban Shootout and all that. It was actually through a Big Brother quite years ago.
Ah, yes.
Because you used to speak to Grace Dent, Davina McCall. You used to always see these little tweets about it. So I think, I'll follow these. They're always talking about Big Brother and that. And then obviously then you start forgetting I followed someone, and then they just pop up in your timeline. And that's probably what I like about it. So it's like, oh, look. And then you'll say something funny and I'll retweet it or reply to it. And you'll reply back. You're quite good at replying back. Obviously,
I did when I did my 100,000th tweet.
I did say that.
I did a thing where you can get your tweets analysed, and 81,900 of my tweets are analysed to followers. Which actually, do you know what? I'm quite proud of.
Yeah,
I'm quite proud of that, because I don't understand. I genuinely don't understand people with a public profile who are on Twitter who don't reply to people.
Yeah.
I don't get it. It's like they're not even remotely engaging in what Twitter is.
Mm.
I think Twitter is a great leveler. You know, it gives you access to everyone. You can send a message to anyone, and that is really, really brilliant. I think that was one of the – when I did Twit Relief for the first time with Emma Freud for Comic Relief, that was one of the things I think that I was so upset about. We raised, I think it was £380 for Jack for Comic Relief, which was amazing, almost, you know. And if you count the 2 years we've done it, we've raised over £500,000 now for Comic Relief, which is amazing. But one of the things that really upset me when we launched that was there was a massive immediate backlash against it from people thinking that we were making Twitter elitist. And I think that was because... I mean, I can understand why, because on the face of it, we were asking people to buy follows from people. But actually, that aspect of it wasn't the important bit. It was all the extra. It was the experiences money can't buy stuff that we were asking people to bid for. But we just used the follow thing as a hook to hang the whole thing on, really. Both Emma and I, it was really upsetting that there was that initial reaction to it. I mean, it did calm down. It calmed down, I think, when people realised that there were all this amazing stuff that we had managed to get for people to bid for.
Mm.
I'm absolutely against this idea of Twitter being a one level for celebrities and another level for everyone else, because I've always thought of it as an all-inclusive medium.
Mm.
And that's how I've treated it. I make no distinction. If you get a reply from me, it's because I think you're funny or you're clever or you've made me stop and think. And or I just like talking to you. You know, that's it. I don't care who you are.
So I've done all right then. Thing is, though, you might now get a lot of people going, "You want to be in my podcast?" And you're going to be like, "Oh, for fuck that fucking Adam Parker. He's opened up a fucking..." You'll be blocking me. You'll be like, "Oh, this bloody bird."
Oh, I will block pedants. That's the only thing. I can't bear Twitter pedants. They drive me around the bend.
What's that mean? What do you mean?
You know, pedants. If you make a typo, there's the one thing. If only there was an edit button on Twitter, so you could immediately correct a spelling mistake. Because sometimes if you're just typing really quickly, or you're using your phone, and it just auto corrects, And then just people, some, they cannot help themselves. They cannot help themselves. Like,
I think you'll find that that apostrophe is in the wrong place. I think you'll find that it's and for it. I think you'll find.
Oh.
Yeah, I hate grammar Nazis and all that. I don't, there's no place for them on Twitter.
They literally just drain the living blood from you, don't they?
Yeah. I just ignore them, or I just end up writing back like something like "you are," so they can't say anything.
I just block them. I literally just block them. I block them immediately. It's like I have absolute zero. Look at this. Poppy, it's not time. You've got half an hour to wait. Listen. Half an hour. No. No, there's no point looking. No, forget it. Go over there and sit over there. Thank you.
that's all there. There you go.
Sorry.
All right, well, let's get towards the end of our chat and what we're doing.
Yes.
Let's talk about the killing.
Yeah.
Because everybody knows. Well, this is how funny it was. When I put a few little messages out this week telling people that, I'm going to be talking to Emma Kennedy. And I may have underestimated how much of a killing fan you are.
Yeah, massive.
Because the amount of people that got back to me and said, you've got to talk about the killing with her. You've got to talk about the killing. And I was like, why? I looked at it, saw you wrote the killing handbook.
Yes.
So like, you're a proper killing geek. So just
I'm a proper killing geek, yeah.
And
That was a job that came about because of Twitter. And stop, hang on a minute. Poppy, stop it. Poppy, stop it. It's not, no, you've got half an, go away. Go away. Go on. Go and sit over there and wait. Thank you. Right, I'll get back to this. Now, so this is a job that came about because of Twitter.
Hmm.
Number one, I only started watching Killing because of Twitter. Because I didn't see the first three episodes first time round. And it wasn't until I started noticing that people I was following were saying, oh, this program's amazing, it's amazing, it's amazing. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to start because the first three episodes were about to go off iPlayer, so I was going to miss them. So I just thought, I'm going to get into this now. And at the end of the first episode, that's it. I was absolutely hooked into it. And so every Saturday when it was on, I started tweeting about it. And because of that, I was asked to host the Killing session up at the Edinburgh TV Festival. And that was the first time I met Sophie.
Yep.
And she and I, we had to spend 24 hours with each other in Edinburgh. And she is honestly, I think, probably one of the finest, most excellent people I think I've ever encountered, full stop. She's just brilliant.
Hmm.
And we got on like a house on, absolutely adored her. And then we kept in touch. And then I went to Copenhagen to visit. And then came back again. And then Ryan approached me and they said, we want to do a book on the killing. Do you want to write it? And so I wrote to Sophie and I said, look, I've been asked to do this. Is this something you're comfortable with? And if you are comfortable with it, you know, can I come and like maybe interview you or something for it? And not only did and say, oh, that's, of course, comfortable with it. But they literally just gave me access all areas. And I was allowed to go out there. I was the only person allowed to be on set other than one other person who's called Neil Midgley, who is also a friend of mine who loves the killing as much as I do. But we were the only people who were allowed to go on set. And I mean, Sophie, she just bent over backwards to help me with that book. Absolutely bent over backwards. And she wrote the foreword for it as well. And it was quite funny because when she was about to write the foreword, she rang me up and she said, what do you want me to say? And I said to her, Sophie, I want you to be as rude about me as you possibly can. just be rude about me. Just literally make out that I'm a mentalist stalker.
Right.
And because this was like our running joke. This is like Sophie and I's running joke between us. Hmm. And so she did. I mean, her, I think her forewords are absolutely hilarious. It makes me laugh. But she's brilliant. She's been nothing but brilliant. They all have. They all have. They've all been amazing. I got to meet all of them. And I'm very good friends with a couple of them now. And they've all just been wonderful. Wonderful. It's been my favourite job ever, that.
I mean, that's like a dream for anybody that watches a show.
Dream come true.
Yeah, if you like a show so much and then get invited to write about it, get paid to write about it, and go on the set.
I know. Sophie gave me her Sarah Lund police card.
Right, that's pretty impressive.
Isn't it?
That is.
Isn't it?
That is pretty good.
It's like weird now because I'm friends with her like properly now. It's like I actually keep forgetting who she is. But when I'm hanging out with her, it's like, oh yeah, look, it's like when she was doing the BFI and I went out for dinner with her afterwards, and it took me ages to get her out of the foyer because all these killing fans were mobbing her, and it was quite weird because I had this moment where I thought, why are they all just bothering Sophie? And oh yeah, she's famous. Yeah. I've got to remember she's quite famous. Yeah.
And then you'll get someone come up to you.
Other people haven't met her before. I have to keep remembering.
Yeah.
Her.
You get a little bit protective of them.
She's just Sophie to me now. She's just Sophie.
And then someone comes up to you and gives you like a clay village of like suburban shootout.
Yeah.
And you're like, yes.
Yeah.
This is me.
I know.
That's brilliant. I mean, I was honest with you, and I said to you that I haven't actually seen the Danish Bacon version of The Killing.
It's terrible, Brendan.
So, I know. See, that's
really, really bad. I mean, the thing that upsets me the most about you, I'm going to be honest.
Go for it.
Is that you even gave the American remake the time of day. I haven't even mentioned it in the Killing Handbook. It's not even acknowledged. Just pretend it doesn't even exist.
All right, well, I'll tell you, I watched one episode.
Adam, look, I know what your problem is because you have tweeted me about this, but your problem is you don't like subtitles.
No,
right?
I was joking. I love subtitle movies. I can sit there. I was messing about.
Please believe me when I say that it is the greatest television program ever made.
I'll definitely give it a go. It's three seasons.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Is it finished now though?
Yeah, that's it.
But that's good for you then, because you know that your book covers all three series, yeah?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't cover the third series because it was a real with the publisher about this because I did want it to cover all three series,
right?
But the publisher wanted it to come out before Christmas,
yeah.
Which would have meant that the book came out before people had seen series three,
right?
Okay. And so the decision was made, a very difficult decision, that there would just be a very tiny chapter on series three rather than the full works on it. But having said that, we might do a further version down the line in which I have got series three covered.
Ah, there you go. See, I'm really impressed with that. I think that is really, really impressive, the fact that you were on Twitter talking about a TV show and you just went, yeah, I really like it. Someone said, write a book about it.
I know, but do you know what? I've got loads of jobs because of Twitter. Loads of jobs because of Twitter. The show that is about to come out, Strange Hill High, in which I played Becky Butters, my entire involvement in that is because I sent one funny tweet to Tracy Thorne,
right.
And the woman who came up with the concept of the show saw it and laughed so much she contacted me and said, "Would you like to write on this show?" And so then this is the show that's been made by the people who did The Simpsons. I mean, it's like the great, it's like all my dreams come true. And I then got involved as a writer on that and helped create the characters. And during the course of doing that, we were having a meeting about casting. And we got to Becky Butters, who it's sort of like being Becky Butters is sort of like being Bart Simpson.
Right, okay.
That's how big a deal it is. And we were all just sitting there wondering who could be Becky Butters. And everyone just looked at me and said, "Well, you are Becky Butters. There's no one else can be Becky Butters. It's you. So I am now Becky Butters." But this is all because of Twitter.
That's a beautiful thing.
I never would have been involved in that show if it hadn't been for Twitter.
So you must be loving it. See, like you said, you misfortune and bad luck haunts you, but then good luck. And, you know, stuff like that is definitely on its way.
Yeah.
Balancing out.
The thing is, I suppose, I think Twitter is definitely an easy place to shine. In many ways, but only if you're not trying. Does that make sense?
Yeah, if you become a bit too spammy
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. I mean, I think you may disagree, but I think it's the ladies who rule Twitter hands down. It's that like all the really, really funny people I follow are all women.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think women get Twitter because we get the chatting thing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with
that. There's always more banter between women than there is between blokes.
Yeah, I get that because I follow a lot of my followers don't seem to be women. They used to do a lot of blogs and all that, but they seem to like talk a lot.
Yeah, talk a lot.
But not just random stuff, not just pointless stuff. Like it's actually quite interesting. I get involved in it, and I just feel like. I seem to feel like someone said to me once, I get a few interviews on the show and that, and someone said, "You get a lot of women on your show, Ed." And I said, "That's because a lot of blokes don't want to talk to me." Because
Do they think it's because you're a bit of a weirdo on the internet, Adam?
Probably. It does sound weird, doesn't it? A guy asking another bloke, say, "Oi, do you want to chat cam to cam? Come on, it's for a podcast." They're like, "Yeah, all right, mate. Yeah, of course it is, of course it is." Mm-hmm. But like, I think like, a lot these women that I talk to, they're like, "Yeah, I chat to you." I don't know. Maybe it's just maybe the way I put it out there is making it easier for people. But yeah, I haven't had. I think I've had one interview with a director guy, and that was it. Everyone else has been women.
It's been ladies.
So it's a lady cast. That's what it is.
Get you. Swiss woo.
Yeah, people think, "Oh, you're chatting them all up." I was like, no one wants to talk to me apart from the ladies. That's how it works. A funny thing I was going to say, like I said, when I told people that I was going to chat to you and I got a good response to that. So my friend told me, she went, "Oh, yeah, you speak to Emma Kennedy, that's amazing." And said, "We named our rat after her."
Did they?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
How cool is that?
What colour is the rat?
I think it's a little black and white one, but I think it's more white.
That's amazing. Whoever that is, please send me a picture of that rat that is called Emma Kennedy. That is like the greatest thing I've ever heard.
Well, what I'll do, when we come off, I'll give you their Twitter name.
Yeah, and
you can you can tweet them, because that was
shocking. Yeah, I'll tweet them.
That was quite... But when you told me, I was like, you did name your rat after Emma Kennedy, didn't you?
That's so brilliant.
So there you go, you got... You know, people like you, they make clay models of stuff, and they name their rats after me.
Rats after me, that's brilliant.
There you go. All right, we're going to have a quick chat before we sign off about the BAFTAs, a quick chat about the BAFTAs. Because you're part of the BAFTAs sort of...
I am, I'm a BAFTA voter, yeah.
So you get to vote for the nominees and all that.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to talk about it, or do they take...
Yeah, I think I am. I I'm really conscientious about the voting process.
Yeah.
And I will watch absolutely everything. And I spend weeks, absolute weeks doing it, and hours thinking long and hard about Poppy. Look. Look at what I'm having to deal with. I mean, honest to God. It's just like, Pops, it's not time yet. You've got at least 20 minutes. Thanks. Now off you go. I'm sorry, Adam. I'm really sorry. I just think this has happened now. It happened last year as well. And it's happened again this year. I cannot help shaking the feeling that I think a lot of the voters are just really lazy.
Yeah.
Really lazy, because there are things that just baffles me that they have been on the shortlist. And it's just people have just gone, oh, these five films will do, and then just vote for them all, rather than actually thinking about it properly. And also, I think this year, I'm really disappointed that we've allowed American films to so dominate.
Like Lincoln.
Yeah.
Ain't even out yet.
Well, and Zero Dark Thirty. I mean, Zero Dark Thirty is all right. It's an all right film.
Mm.
But it's not a best film.
No.
Not in a million years. Not in a million years. And, you know, it's like, well, I'll take Sightseers. What a beautiful, beautiful British, low-budget British film that we had this year. It's charming, it's funny, it's got Alice Lowe in it and Steve Oram, who we should be cherishing and encouraging and saying, yes, you know, you two are a real proper talent and we want to see you do more things. And it absolutely deserved to get a nod from BAFTA, and it's got nothing. It's not even in the... It's not even... I mean, when you've got Seven Psychopaths...
Yeah.
...is in the best British, most outstanding British film, and the only reason it's qualified for that is because of funding, which is sort... It's sort of... That sort of feels like cheating to me. That's allowing... ostensibly American films who are sort of getting round things with fundage percentages or whatever. I mean, like, the director, it's also eligible for Best Irish Film because the director has dual citizenship.
Okay.
And that, I tell you what it is, although that's within the rules, for me, that's not within the spirit.
Mm.
Of what that category should be about. And I think BAFTA need to have a long, hard look about properly recognising truly British work.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the British film industry gets a little bit pushed to the side a little bit.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get as... Like, that's a platform. BAFTA's a platform for films like that. And isn't it to kind of say, yeah, but if we only ever talk about British films, it's a very English thing to do, a British thing to do. If we only talk about ourselves, then no one will want to know about it. You're like, well, the Oscars is all about them. It's all about Hollywood.
Yeah.
So why can't we take...
They couldn't give a toot.
No. Yeah. Why don't we take the BAFTAs and really embrace and say, look, there's some great British films out this year.
Yeah, let's, we should. Know. We absolutely should. We absolutely should, and it's like the BAFTAs have been hijacked.
Yeah,
it's like they're Oscars light, and I don't like that. I'm a great fan of this little nation of ours and all the talent that is in it, and I think we should be celebrating that more, and I think we should absolutely be in the minute that anyone new comes up and is great and shows promise and shows you know, great invention and creative wit, then those are the people we should be honouring and encouraging, not the same old, same old, same old.
Do you know what you should do? I think we should start up our own Emma Kennedy Awards or something.
Do you? I'd have sightseers on it for a start.
There you go. We should, on Twitter, go on Twitter. Just randomly go on Twitter.
The
Kennedy Awards. There you go. And then just start giving them out to people.
You've won a Kennedy.
Yeah. People will just get these tweets. They'll be like, well done, you won a Kennedy. They're like, way! And we get your friend, the person that made the little clay village, to make little Kennedy Awards.
Make little Kennedys. We'll do it. We'll do it. We'll have the alternative awards, the Kennedys.
Right, okay, so...
celebrating the little people.
That's it. Right, I think we've reached the end of the podcast.
It was a delight, Adam. I enjoyed it very much. I'm sorry that my dog tried to hijack it all the way through.
That's right. Maybe next time I'll get your dog on and you can hijack the conversation.
Just talk to her. Talk to Poppy.
Yeah, I'm used to talking to my dogs all the time, so we probably get on, it'll be all right. Yeah, and if you, every now and again, you can just poke your head over.
Just do a dog cast.
Yeah, I think that's the future.
Yeah.
That could work. So, yeah.
So if you would like to find me anywhere on the net, then you can very easily. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at EmmaK67, or you can visit my website, which is www.emmakennedy.net. And I've been Emma Kennedy, and you've been listening to the Oddcast Podcast.